It has been my real privilege while working here to get to know many of you who are here tonight, our great friends. Many of you have given your spiritual support, many of you have given your financial support, and we're grateful for that, for all of the support that you've provided to us. Our outreach is very important into the community, and you are part of that outreach activity. I suppose I'm wonderfully reflecting when we come to the end of our five-year term, and it would be nice if we could let that sound a little better. I reflect on that every time I'm in this room.
That's better.
But can you still hear me?
Yes.
Good. I always think these microphones are meant for men and not for women as we go forward. We have made a great many changes in the library, and the library will continue to change. I was at a meeting yesterday where Charles Darwin was quoted again as we must adapt to our environment or we will not survive, and that's what libraries must do. We have 3.6 million people through our branch libraries every year. For every hour that any student spends in class, he or she spends 3 or 4 hours in the library. Most of you sitting here can probably look back on where you sat in a library when you studied many years ago. So we really appreciate the support that you continue to provide so that we can continue to serve all our students here at McGill. Well, I'd now like to introduce to you Judge Alan Hilton. Alan is a member of the Committee of the Friends of the Library and has provided enormous support so far to us, and we're looking to even more assistance as we go forward. And I will ask him now to introduce this evening's speaker. Thank you.
Well, it's always a privilege for a McGill graduate, and I know some of them are in the room this evening who spent some time in this room, to speak at this podium and to preside at an event of this nature. This evening, the Friends of the McGill Library continues its tradition of having a distinguished guest at the F.R. Scott Lecture speak on a topic that reflects one of the domains of interest and achievement of Frank Scott, who is law dean, advocate, poet, and public policy thinker, left so indelible a mark, not only on McGill, but on the rest of the country as well. The topic selected by our speaker tonight, F.R. Scott and the Evolution of Language Law in Canada, is always one of interest to jurists and non-jurists alike. As fate would have it, Frank Scott died in 1985. Not long after the Supreme Court of Canada began in 1984 to interpret the first cases that came to it involving the Canadian Charter. F.R. Scott would have seen during his lifetime the adoption of Canada's Official Language Act in 1969, Quebec's Official Language Act, better known as Bill 22, in 1974, Quebec's Charter of the French Language, adopted in 1977, better known as Bill 101, and the Canadian Charter, which came into force on April 17, 1982. He was also a member of the World Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism that was established by the Pearson government, and its report was the genesis of the Federal Official Languages Act. For most of his life, however, there was really only one specific provision in Canadian law dealing with language rights that would have been a specific application to him as a resident of Quebec and member of the Bar of Quebec. That would be Section 133 of the Constitution Act 1867, which requires the Parliaments of Canada and the Legislature of Quebec to adopt statutes in both French and English, and which permits the use of both French or English in the legislatures of Canada and Quebec, as well as in pleadings or processes of those courts. Frank Scott also would have been and have read The unanimous judgments of the Supreme Court of Canada and Attorney General of Canada against Blakey, decided in 1979, and Attorney General of Quebec against the Quebec Association of Provincial School Boards, decided in 1984. Both of these judgments invalidated provisions of the Charter of the French Language, the first on the basis of Section 133 of the Constitution Act 1867, and the second on the basis of the minority language education provisions in Section 23 of the Canadian Charter. We are therefore left to wonder how he would have viewed the current state of affairs in Canada, and in particular in his home province, of the evolution of language laws in the close to 25 years since his death. Our speaker this evening, Raymond Fraser, is particularly well suited to address this issue, not the least because he actually knew Frank Scott from his childhood, when the Scotts and Fraser's parents shared a country home in North Africa. When Prime Minister Trudeau introduced the Official Languages Act in 1969, he evidently had in mind someone such as Ray Fraser to occupy the position of Commissioner of Official Languages, a position that requires a combination of flawless command of both languages, sensitivity to the needs of linguistic minorities, and the inevitable resistance of governments, as well as a heavy dose of persuasiveness and diplomacy. After graduating from the University of Toronto with bachelor's and master's degrees, Raymond Fraser embarked on a remarkable journalistic career that saw him as a reporter and commentator for periodicals and newspapers, including the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, Le Devoir, and Maclean's. Not surprisingly, his appointment as Commissioner of Official Languages by the current government was widely applauded. In his seminal book, Sorry I Don't Speak French, he explains his initial contact with the use of French as opposed to the simple study of French as a participant in an archaeological training project in the summer of 1965, just south of Montreal, that attracted students from Quebec and elsewhere in Canada in equal numbers. It was there, as he describes it, that he became immersed in the head-spinning process of absorbing another language as it is spoken, rather than as it is articulated by high school and first-year university French teachers. Those of us in the audience who emerged from Quebec's English school system, where French was taught as a subject somewhat like algebra, with the slightest reference to the necessity of actually understanding and using French in Quebec, would quickly sympathize with that experience. When you only read this extract from the review of his book, published in 2006, to understand why he was an ideal candidate to become Commissioner of Official Languages. In order to combat the passive-aggressive tendencies of our national psyche, Fraser has produced a practical plan for understanding and rectifying Canada's language policy. First, he presents a meticulously researched history of the growth and evolution of official bilingualism. Then his talents as a journalist shine through as he presents a series of vivid case studies examining the effects of his policy and everything from social etiquette in Ottawa to how Stephen Harper learned to speak French with such a debonair accent. And so I'm delighted to turn the podium over to Graham Fraser. He will not likely try to relate Frank Scott to Stephen Harper, but he will surely provide a thought-provoking analysis of Canada's evolution from that single provision in our founding constitutional document to the current state of language laws, not only as those laws are written, but as they are experienced by Canadians across the country. Greg?
What an intimidating introduction. It's an honor and a pleasure to be asked to deliver the F.R. Scott Lecture. Frank Scott was, in the words of political scientist Alan Mills, arguably Canada's most accomplished all-round public intellectual of the 20th century. But he was not only a giant in the fields of Canadian politics, jurisprudence, constitutional law, and poetry. He was, as Judge Hilton mentioned, a towering figure in my childhood. My parents and the Scotts were co-owners of a summer place in Northampton, and I have some vivid memories of his wit and laughter. I remember quite vividly one point his recounting how he had met a scientist who had been doing some study of rats and had discovered that if you placed an electric probe in the pleasure point in the brain rats would continue to bang away on this, to give electrical impulses to this pleasure point. They would stop eating, they would stop drinking until they finally collapsed. And every time Frank Scott saw this scientist, they would lock eyes across the room and stamp away. And I've always felt that of all the various principles that Frank Scott defended during his life, the pleasure principle was certainly one of them. The late Michael Oliver, who was also a renowned figure at McGill, once observed that everyone knew a different Frank Scott. Indeed, previous lectures have touched on his influence on Canadian social welfare policy and his legacy in areas of human rights, anti-fascism, poetry, free speech, party politics, and constitutional law. This year is the 110th anniversary of his birth, and I'd like to trace the development of Scott's thinking about French Canada and the impact that he had on language rights and language legislation. When he died almost 25 years ago, he was worried that he'd lost his fight for bilingualism. He'd hoped that Quebec's bilingualism would be a model for the rest of Canada and was furious about Quebec's language laws. He feared they would provoke a backlash against French and the rest of Canada and was angry about what he felt were myths being propagated about Quebec's English community. It's true that his vision of a bilingual Quebec inspiring a bilingual Canada did not come to pass. Over the years, Scott moved from being a defender and explainer of French language rights to a sometimes bitter defender of the English minority in Quebec. But with a little distance, it's possible to see how important his influence was in fighting for a Charter of Rights and in defining language as a human right. He saw the Constitution as the vessel that contained the philosophical rules and principles that govern relations between individuals and cultural groups, and their relations with the state. Those relations are as critical now as they've ever been. He once wrote, bringing together in two sentences his life's work both as a lawyer and as a poet, "If human rights and harmonious relations between cultures are forms of the beautiful, then the state is a work of art that is never finished. Law thus takes its place in its theory and practice among man's highest and most creative activities." He was born in Quebec City in 1899, and Frank Scott was a Rhodes Scholar who, on returning to Montreal, became engaged not only in English-speaking political and cultural life, but also with French Canada. His best-known commentary on bilingualism was in a poem first published in 1954, entitled "Bonne Entente." "The advantages of living with two cultures strike one at every turn, especially when one finds a notice in an office building, 'This elevator will not run on Ascension Day,' or reads in the Montreal Star, 'Tomorrow being the feast of the Immaculate Conception, there will be no garbage collection in the city,' or sees on the restaurant menu the bilingual dish, 'Deep apple pie, tarte aux pommes profonde.'" In fact, language in all its forms was a passion of Scott's, as a poet, as a translator, and as a legal scholar. And he never forgot his childhood in Quebec City. "When I was 8 years old, I watched the great pageant on the Plains of Abraham celebrating the tercentenary of the founding of Quebec by Samuel de Champlain in 1608," he recalled later. "I grew up understanding the import of the nostalgic motto of Quebec, 'Je me souviens.' Every Saint-Jean-Baptiste parade on the 24th of June portrayed scenes from the Ancien Régime. French Canada and its history were all about me." One of Scott's early memories also included the conscription riot in Quebec City during World War I, a memory that haunted him years later. Scott attended Bishop's and a small college, and on his return from Oxford, studied law at McGill. He combined his interest in language and the law as a summer student in a law office, finding the work rather tedious. He translated the Coutume de Paris, the source of Quebec civil law, and he always cherished the continuity that flowed through the civil code back to old France and to ancient Rome. In 1928, he started teaching law at McGill, and as he put it, the next year the whole North American economy collapsed. One could not live through the Great Depression and remain politically unaffected. During the grim years that followed, he became politically active as one of the authors of the Regina Manifesto that created the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, the CCF, precursor to the New Democratic Party. At the same time, as he became engaged in the Montreal literary scene, he began to reach out to French-speaking writers and artists. However, his relationship to French-speaking Quebec was ambiguous. On the one hand, he was attracted to the language and culture. But while drawn to rebels and reformers, poets and intellectuals, and sympathetic to the economic discrimination suffered by French-speaking Canadians, Scott was repelled by the dominant ideology of clerical conservatism and cut off from much of what was going on in literary Quebec in the 1930s and 1940s. It was only later that he became the major translator of French-speaking, French-language poetry, and in particular, Annie Vaz's work. Politically, during that early period, Scott saw French Canadians as passive victims, prey to manipulation by what he called the provincial trinity, the Liberal Party machine, the Roman Church, and St. James Street, the Theo-Pluto bureaucracy. That analysis, formed during the Depression, profoundly shaped his views, that weak provincial governments allowed corporations free rein, that French-Canadian nationalism was at risk of becoming proto-fascist through manipulation of what he called the French masses, and that a strong federal government was necessary to protect minority and social rights from corporate exploitation and the resentment of the oppressed majority. In a formulation that echoes Sir John A. Macdonald's famous suggestion that if Canadian, French Canadians were treated as a nation, they would act generously, and if they were called a faction, they would be factious, in 1936, Scott wrote, "If French Canadian nationalists are simply met with imperialist ballyhoo, orange cries, Protestant bigotry, and Anglo-Saxon conceit, they will prevail. If they are met with sympathy, understanding, and reasonable concessions, French Canadians may be satisfied with something less than the breakup of the Dominion." Scott saw the role of the church in Quebec nationalist discourse as being one of, and I quote, "teaching people to be content with poor and depressed living standards when they could enjoy the fuller and richer lives which greater economic security makes possible," which he saw as a form of enslavement. So sympathy, understanding, and reasonable concessions were not always easy for Scott to contemplate. This frustration also emerges in the 1943 book that he wrote with David Lewis, Make This Your Canada. They could not imagine anyone who appreciated democratic equality questioning the value of bilingualism and of what they called the two converging streams of literature, art, culture, and traditions. But they blamed capitalism for exploiting the differences between French and English and saw bigotry on both sides of the language barrier. On the one hand, a small group of bigoted and intolerant English-speaking Canadians have always sought to deprive French Canada of its rights, they wrote. On the other, a small group of equally bigoted French-speaking Canadians have played on the genuine grievances of their compatriots to encourage a narrow and antisocial provincialism. This was all part of Scott's desire to lay the groundwork, to try to build bridges between French-speaking and English-speaking intellectuals. And at the same period, it's also possible to see the beginning of Scott's exploration of the connection between individual rights and collective rights in Canada, and his ever clearer sense of the role of language rights in that relationship. In 1947, and this picks up something that Judge Hilton was referring to, he began a short article for Queen's Quarterly by taking issue with a British Columbia letter writer who had suggested to a weekly publication that while French was the mother tongue of 3 million people in Canada, 3 million people in Quebec, Canada was not a bilingual country. English, this person wrote, is the official language of the rest of Canada and of 130 million people in the United States. It was an argument that Scott, 2 decades before the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism, had no patience for. "British Columbia is already, in a very important respect, a bilingual province," he wrote. "So are all the other common law provinces. Canada is a bilingual country, and British Columbia can truthfully be called a bilingual province." Expressing surprise that this needed to be clarified 80 years after the British North America Act, Scott pointed out that Section 133 of the Act meant that every piece of federal legislation is published in 2 official languages and that each version has the force of law. Thus, he wrote, The actions, rights, and duties of Canadians in British Columbia as elsewhere are just as much governed by the French version of federal law as they are by the English. Moreover, he pointed out that in 1935, Chief Justice Duff of the Supreme Court used the difference in distinction between the French version and the English version of the Act to decide a case. Scott found it difficult to understand why so many people in Canada should resist the idea that French should be officially recognized. But in his conclusion to this piece, he alluded once again to one particular aspect, the differing perspectives on individual and collective rights. Those who supported individual civil liberties had trouble accepting collective rights, while the French-speaking minority was more concerned for minority rights than for individual liberties. What is needed, he wrote, is a blending of the two correlative ideas. This was a significant part of Frank Scott's life work, trying to balance these two sometimes conflicting principles of individual civil liberties and minority rights and establish a dialogue between those who stressed one rather than the other. The Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, enshrined in the Constitution Act 1982, 35 years later, represents the blending that Scott called for in 1947, even though Scott himself was unhappy with some of the compromises that were contained in the Charter. In 1949, in an article for the Canadian Bar Review, Scott pointed out that traditionally fundamental freedoms have been individual freedoms, but that there are certain group freedoms recognized by a democratic society. Actually, he wrote, the Canadian Constitution has more definite protection for groups, minorities, than it has for individuals. The guarantees for the use of the two languages, for instance, and for denominational schools are group freedoms. Once again, Scott was trying to reconcile individual rights and group rights. These were more complicated for him, given the conservative Catholic nationalist interpretation given to collective rights in Quebec, but he stressed that both were clearly part of the constitutional rights defined by the British North America Act. That same year, in 1947, Scott was attacked by McGill authorities for his public affiliation with the CCF, and not long after passed over for the position of Dean of Law. In the years that followed, he devoted more energy to translation and poetry, as well as to progressive organizations in Canada and Quebec, and in doing so, had a major influence on a young lawyer and lecturer, Pierre Trudeau. In addition, he would organize social evenings of English-speaking and French-speaking poets, which, while friendly enough, were apparently somewhat awkward. We were glad to meet them, they were glad to meet us, that's about it, recalled Louis Dudek years later. Similarly, several of the Francophones found Scott's French formal and literary and his attitude, albeit certainly unintentionally, patrician, paternalistic, and condescending. The novelist and Dr. Jacques Ferrand even used Scott as a symbolic representation of English domination of Quebec in his novels and attacked Scott publicly, saying he's always been the Anglo, he's on the side of the exploiters. Scott's support of the War Measures Act in 1970 only confirmed Ferrand's view. In 1963, Prime Minister Lester Pearson asked Scott to be a member of the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism, which would be co-chaired by André Laurendeau and Davidson Dunton. It was there that Scott's views on language and bilingualism would be challenged, sharpened, and in some cases rejected. While he had a national reputation, Scott was named as the only representative of the English minority in Quebec. It was a key to his identity in many ways. He knew all the members of the Quebec members of the commission, and with the exception of Dunton, who had spent early part of his career in Montreal, he knew none of the members from the rest of Canada. Laurendeau and Dunton were the co-chairs, but the real debate, intellectual, emotional, linguistic, and national, was between Laurendeau and Scott. Both men had subtle minds, political idealism, personal charisma, and a poet's sensibility. As Laval political scientist Guy Laforêt wrote in an essay on the two men, both were éminence keys, intellectual leaders of Quebec and English-speaking Canada, respectively. Scott's view was that although French Canada could legitimately be considered a nation, Quebec was, or should be, a bilingual society. After a private meeting of the commissioners in 1964, he wrote in the journal that he kept, "In further conversation about the two-nation theory, I said, Quebec is a unilingual, unicultural society, while English Canada is a unilingual, multicultural society." Laurendeau agreed. Scott's ideal was that this bilingual model should be extended to Canada as a whole, so that the limited rights defined in the British North America Act would be extended, and the language rights that had been extinguished in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta would be restored. Le Hondo's view, on the other hand, eloquently expressed in the blue pages of the first volume of the report of the Royal Commission, was that the survival of French in Canada and North America depended upon a strong French-speaking society in Quebec. While he admired Le Hondo's independence of thought and his opposition to Du Plessis, in other words, he wrote quite a moving tribute to Le Hondo when Le Hondo died, mentioning his Le Hondo's courageous opposition to the Franco regime in Spain, making him really quite unique among his colleagues of Quebec nationalists at the time. Scott did occasionally fulminate at the myths he felt that Le Hondo perpetuated about the English community in Quebec, arguing only in the economic area do the English have a privileged place. In other activities, as well as in politics, it's a handicap to belong to the English minority. But both men were appalled by the ignorance and prejudice they encountered toward French in Canada during the Commission's visit to Western Canada. Both were also taken aback to the degree to which separatists were dominating public discussion in Quebec. Scott did not lose his quick wit during some of those stormy hearings. At a meeting in Sherbrooke, a young man said that he cared nothing about the French-speaking minorities outside Quebec, that the only minority that mattered was the English minority in Quebec, and they should leave as soon as possible. Je suis, j'y reste, quipped Scott. I'm here and I'm staying. It was a phrase that reflected his sometimes defiant definition of himself as a Quebecer, part of a community with deep roots in society and a community that was not going to disappear or pick up and leave. I have no idea whether there's any connection or not, but that phrase, je suis, j'y reste, became a no-campaign slogan in the referendum of 1980. It's possible to trace the evolution of Scott's thinking during the period of the Royal Commission in the 1960s by reading his journal and some of the memos he wrote. Over the years, he moved from his initial optimism to becoming increasingly depressed and pessimistic. On August 11, 1965, Scott wrote a memo for the Commission entitled A View of Canada. He began on an upbeat note, summarizing Canada's advantages as a prosperous, developed democracy with two international working languages. However, as the preliminary report had made clear, the country was passing through a crisis. Scott identified three factors that emerged, as he put it, to disturb and threaten the original scheme of Confederation: the changing functions of government in the modern state, I quote, the increasing sense of identity and purpose in the French-Canadian nation and its mounting dissatisfaction with the position in which the original constitution left it, both in Quebec and in other provinces, and what he called the slow but steady absorption of the Canadian economy into the American system of large corporate enterprise. It's interesting to note that Scott, at that point, stresses the positive elements of French-Canadian nationalism, the increasing sense of identity and purpose, and the broader context of governance and American corporate dominance. In that paper, he rejected the idea that Quebec alone should assume responsibility for French-Canadian culture, calling this idea historically false and morally reprehensible. His view, and he added, which I trust is the view of this commission, was that every government in Canada had the function of defending both cultures. Quebec, he argued, would remain the center of French culture, but would reject unilingualism and any form of forcible francization, setting the model for other provinces to adopt more bilingualism. The federal government would develop its bilingual and bicultural character progressively throughout its administration, he wrote. Ottawa must remain what it is now, one of the governments for all the French people in Canada, just as Quebec is one of the governments for all the English in Quebec. No government on this theory belongs to a single race or religion or favors one more than another. As always, Scott saw the federal government as a crucial level for progressive change. But he was increasingly concerned that Quebec was moving away from bilingualism. In Quebec, he wrote, which inherited a bicultural society from before Confederation, this trend seems to be moving toward unilingualism. Many examples could be cited, he observed. The Quebec government does not have to introduce, but to preserve biculturalism. It would be tragic and comic if it disappeared in Quebec just as it was appearing elsewhere. He had difficulty in resolving the paradox of official bilingualism, the idea that the institutions of the state should become bilingual so that individuals can remain unilingual. It was a paradox spelled out by one of the researchers for the Royal Commission, William Mackey, who explained that bilingual countries were not created to promote bilingualism, but to guarantee the maintenance and use of one or more official languages. At first, Scott was a bit taken aback by this idea. In regard to this idea of promoting unilingualism, I confess that, perhaps lacking French logic, I could not see how a commission appointed to promote bilingualism could end up favoring the promotion of unilingualism, he wrote a bit sardonically. Gradually it dawned on me, and I think on the others, that what Mackey meant was that unless there was a strong degree of unilingualism in the bilingual country for each language, one would eventually dominate and assimilate the other. Promoting unilingualism and having two essentially unilingual groups did not exclude the possibility that individual members of each group might be able to speak the other language as well. That paradox and Scott's description of it has had a substantial impact on my own thinking about language in Canada. There's always been a facile criticism of language policy in Canada under the Official Languages Act that assumed that the purpose of Canada's language policy and of the Official Languages Act was that everybody should become bilingual. Everybody's not bilingual, ergo, the policy has been a failure. But if one defines the policy as one that's intended to make governments able to serve citizens in the language of their choice, so that citizens do not have to become bilingual, the policy is then both more pragmatic and more achievable. It's also a policy that both assures the individual's right to deal with the federal government in the official language that the individual chooses, and one that protects, promotes, and takes positive measures for minority language communities. Thus, it's a policy that protects both individual rights and collective rights. In August 1967, in a comment objecting to two paragraphs in the draft of the first volume of the report, Scott explicitly laid out his view of language as a human right. It's an eloquent defense of language as a right and of the English-speaking minority in Quebec. The right to one's language in all personal and private relations is a human right. It is as inherent in man as his freedom of speech or of conscience, he wrote. It starts with mother and child. It continues into wider social groupings. It is not granted by the state or by constitutions. Laws may protect it and may prescribe conditions under which it may be reasonably exercised, particularly in dealing with state authorities. He went on to dismiss the idea of having more than two official languages, to stress the importance of the English language in Quebec. The English-speaking community, then 800,000 strong, and the largest language minority in Quebec, in Canada, and to underline the importance of the then existing 1867 Constitution. The English community's relations with linguistic relations with the French, a good example of equal partnership, he wrote, have been developed over 200 years and provide a model which is a powerful influence for changes in other provinces, which have been slow to grant French similar rights where they are justified even by their much smaller French minorities. The economic development in Quebec creates difficult problems for the French majority that we're going to speak about in another volume and to which an answer must be found. I'm not suggesting that the linguistic status quo in Quebec is to remain as at present, far from it. But Section 133 of the BNA Act is not an obstacle but a great help, and it makes for an equal partnership within Quebec and is based on human rights which even the independence of Quebec would not call into question. In the discussions in that fall of 1967, Scott found himself in a minority, as he put it, the only voice for a bilingual Quebec. He ultimately dissented from the recommendations in Volume 4 of the Commission's report, arguing that by recommending the working language in Quebec be French, the Commission was contradicting the earlier rejection of a territorial solution to the language issue. The final note that Scott struck was a pessimistic one, a 10-page legal-sized document poignantly entitled The End of the Affair, undated, but I'm assuming on the basis of the internal evidence that it was written in 1970, but before the October crisis. In this, he noted that the Commission's work was over, but the crisis in Quebec was not, but warned that the recommendations could not solve all the problems of national unity. I will close on a personal note, he wrote. It is astonishing and also frightening for me to watch Quebec abandon so many of its ancient virtues and values in order to rush into the North American capitalist system with arms open for the embrace. The values of that system I learned to despise and reject in the 1930s. I had hoped that the Catholic tradition, with its greater emphasis on social obligations, would somehow mitigate the prevailing Protestant ethic of free enterprise. It's a poignant sign of age that at 70, he nostalgically saw virtues and values, where at 33, he denounced the church for interpreting the Depression as a sort of punishment from God upon greedy individuals. Then came the October crisis of 1970, the kidnapping of James Cross and Pierre Lapocque by the Front Libération du Québec, the invocation of the War Measures Act, and the murder of Laporte. Unlike many civil libertarians and progressives, including his wife Marion, Scott supported the imposition of the War Measures Act, saying that democracy had to protect itself and the War Measures Act was the only instrument to restore order. Again, he was haunted by the riots in Quebec City in 1918. I heard the machine guns on the streets of Quebec City during the conscription riots and saw for the first time a crisis leading to bloodshed, which left deep and lasting wounds in the body politic, he wrote. He'd seen students breaking up public meetings for the delegates of the Spanish Republican government in 1936, two riots in Montreal in 1969, two kidnappings in 1970, and what he concluded was a further erosion of civil government. A shock treatment was needed to restore the balance, he wrote. It was given, and it worked. There was only one death, and it was not caused by the forces of law and order. There was another casualty, however. For Scott, his position on the War Measures Act meant an irreparable breach with French-speaking writers and poets, nationalists who had previously been friends. A further breach occurred with the introduction of Bill 22 by the Bourassa government in 1974, which declared French to be the official language of Quebec. The bill galvanized Scott into defense of the English minority. Scott went through the bill clause by clause, declaring one after another to be misleading, clearly unconstitutional, discriminatory, undemocratic, and coercive and oppressive. In one marginal note that I saw in his copy of the Act, which is in his papers in the archives, he wrote, building contracts for McGill must be in French. And in another, minority has no right to its language from Hydro. He maintained, as he always had, that for all federal undertakings, English as well as French was an official language in Quebec. So when the bill says French is the official language, it suggests it's the only official language, and this is quite false, Scott told the Montreal Star, listing off points where he felt the bill was unconstitutional, undemocratic, and coercive. The interview, while passionate and detailed, had little impact. On July 31, 1974, the bill was adopted, becoming Quebec's official language act. Scott joined a legal team challenging the constitutionality of legislation on behalf of the Protestant School Board of Greater Montreal, but the appeal from the initial rejection by the Quebec Court of Appeal failed. A few months later, his tone shifted to rage and frustration at the language situation in Quebec in a letter to his old friend and CCFNDP colleague George Cadbury in January 1977. A dumber and more frightened crowd than the English minority in Quebec, it would be hard to find, he fumed. Business won't lift a finger. It will conform or move out, leaving its skeleton staff behind, fed instructions by computer from Toronto. McGill is frozen with fright. Its money, even the large amount coming from Ottawa, is challenged through Quebec. The only active fighters are the tiny little Protestant school boards and the Italians. We don't deserve to survive as we have no collective will to live. But by the time it reached the Court of Appeal, the Quebec Official Language Act no longer existed. The Parti Québécois had been elected in 1976, and in 1977, it replaced the Official Language Act with Bill 101, which became the even more stringent Chartrand Française. Scott's worst fears of Quebec unilingualism had come to pass. His friends remarked on his bitterness. You know, for years I've spoken French wherever I've had the opportunity, he said to Eugene Forcey during a discussion on Bill 22. Now I'm damned if I'll speak French. He became equally bitter that Trudeau, despite strong urging from his former mentor, did not use the federal government's power of disallowance to strike down the Quebec language legislation. One of the last times I saw Frank Scott was in the fall of 1978. He just won the Governor General's Award for Nonfiction for his essays on the Constitution. And while enjoying the honor, he was gloomy about language in the constitutional debate. As he saw me to the door at their house on Clark Avenue, he remarked that he was rereading Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. 4 years later, when the Constitution was patriated with a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, Scott felt a mixture of pride and disappointment. The night before, at a reception for Rhodes Scholars, old and new, Pierre Trudeau had literally wept with joy when he introduced Scott to the Queen, saying, "Everything I learned about the Constitution I learned from this man." Scott was both deeply proud of the recognition and bitter that Trudeau had not done more. He would retell that story often, adding with a rueful flourish, "He didn't learn enough." And he was angry, bound off, as he said in the letter, that there were no English-Canadian names among the signatures on the charter. 2.5 years later, in January 1985, Scott died. Near the end of his life, he wondered if he'd been a failure, if he should have focused on poetry instead of politics. It's true that his vision for Quebec and Canada did not survive. Canada's language regime is characterized by remarkable asymmetry, with Quebec being officially unilingually French, New Brunswick being officially bilingual, the territory of Nunavut officially trilingual, and other provinces having a wide range of minority language policies from substantial to virtually non-existent. It's a regime built on a series of compromises, and Scott hated compromises, above all in questions that he saw as fundamental, minority language rights and the powers of the federal government. Since Sandra Joie's biography, published 22 years ago, darker references to Scott have circulated in some of the academic writing about him. He has been described as paternalistic and condescending, Victorian and aristocratic, a cultivated, well-intentioned and polite gentleman poet who was slightly out of sync with the community he wanted to join, and a poet-performer domestic tyrant. However, almost 25 years after his death, it's also easier to see the magnitude of his achievements. His influence on Pierre Trudeau, while not as great as he'd hoped, was huge, as it was on several generations of lawyers and legal scholars. I'm told his spirit still can be felt in the bricks of this building. His contribution to the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism was enormous. His thinking was an inspiration for the debates that led to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. His clarity of thought, defining language rights as human rights, laid the groundwork for an edifice of jurisprudence on language. And his insistence on the rule of law presaged the critical role that the courts have played in defining language rights. The groundbreaking Supreme Court decision on the secession of Quebec, with its definition of minority rights as one of the central elements of Canadian democracy, stands on the foundation that he helped build. Frank Scott laid out clearly, before the courts established the principle in law and jurisprudence, that language rights are human rights. As he so eloquently put it, "If human rights and harmonious relations between cultures are forms of the beautiful, then the state is a work of art that is never finished." And the English community, with which Scott had such a deep and complicated relationship, has endured and transformed itself, becoming more bilingual than ever before. Now, 45 years after he made the quip, 900,000 members of the English-speaking community can say, as Scott did, "Je suis, je reste." Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Fraser, Madam Director Schmidt, Mr. Justice Hilton, friends of the library, colleagues and friends. My name's Lionel Smith, and it's my honor and my privilege this evening to say on behalf of the Faculty of Law a few words of thanks to our speaker, Mr. Fraser, on the occasion of that extraordinary, deeply interesting and enriching lecture. I confess that even if I had had the opportunity to give Mr. Fraser the subject of his lecture tonight, as perhaps a professor is used to doing, I couldn't have chosen a subject that was more interesting for me personally, nor one that was more appropriate for this lecture and indeed for this place. I never met F.R. Scott, but in a way I feel I've got to know him quite well since I came to McGill. His spirit walks in these halls. On the walls, we have pictures of him, and indeed a painting given to us in his memory. There are tributes to him, and indeed the text of one of his poems. We have a chair named for him, the F.R. Scott Chair in Public and Constitutional Law. The Friends of the Library, of course, have this wonderful lecture named for F.R. Scott, and I stop, if I may, just to congratulate the Friends for creating and sustaining such an important tradition, on the fact that tonight we celebrate the 20th lecture in this wonderful series. We have also here in the faculty the F.R. Scott Award for Distinguished Service to the faculty. But I think what would have been more important than any of that to F.R. Scott is that our students read the cases that he argued and won and the constitutional texts that his thought helped to shape. And perhaps what would have been even more important to him is that that's not true just at McGill. I read those texts when I was in my first year of law school, far away in Ontario. It's a very different place, London, Ontario, in distance and of course in culture. But in agreement with Mr. Fraser's conclusion, Scott's influence was national and indeed international on many of the aspects about which he cared passionately. Dans sa conférence ce soir, M. Fraser a bien évoqué l'esprit de F.R. Scott, un esprit juridique, mais aussi artistique et créatif, motivé toujours par une quête pour la justice. La justice dans toutes ses formes, mais surtout en ce qui concernait la liberté du citoyen. La liberté de s'exprimer dans sa propre langue, d'avoir accès aux services publics, d'avoir accès à la justice elle-même dans sa propre langue. Ce sont des droits primordiaux pour un citoyen libre dans une société libre. One of the points in that wonderful lecture that most struck me was the reference to some of the paradoxes in the idea of official bilingualism, the paradox that in some sense we promote bilingualism to protect the rights of those who are unilingual. If I may, I wanted to expand on that just a little bit because in a sense I've come to think that in the law we have a paradox on top of that paradox, which relates to a point that Mr. Fraser mentioned, that is the interpretation of bilingual texts. He referred to a case that was decided by Chief Justice Dunn, in which the French text was used to help understand the meaning of the text together. We do our best here at McGill, and I hope other faculties do as well, to inculcate this as a kind of reflex when a student is dealing with a bilingual text. If there is some ambiguity, the immediate reflex should be to look to the other language for enlightenment. And it may be that the two texts together, read in harmony, will speak with one voice, and so you come to understand the intent and the meaning of the law. And of course, the paradox of that is it suggests that you need to be bilingual to understand the legislation properly. But of course, if everyone was bilingual, you wouldn't need bilingual legislation. Or in other words, the goal of the legislation is to provide a text of the law that someone can understand who only speaks one of the two official languages. And yet, it seems to be really the consensus that in order to understand that law, you need to be able to read both texts. I don't have a solution to that paradox, but I'm working on it. Tonight we thank Mr. Fraser not only for his fascinating lecture, but also for the work he's doing on behalf of all Canadians as the Commissioner for Official Languages. This is indeed a challenging and multifaceted role, one that Mr. Fraser has seized with vigor and with a vision informed by his wide experience as a journalist and writer in both official languages and in many different parts of Canada. Dans cette vision, il a décidé de mettre l'accent sur l'enseignement des langues officielles. Cette décision a une résonance toute particulière ici à la Faculté de droit, où nous vivons quotidiennement les défis, la joie et parfois les paradoxes d'un environnement bilingue et où nous sommes convaincus qu'il est impossible de comprendre la nature bijuridique du droit canadien sans comprendre et vivre sa nature bilingue. With all of these paradoxes, it seems to me official bilingualism is really more of a journey than a destination. And I think I can speak for all of us when I say we're very glad to have Mr. Fraser with his formidable abilities at work on that file on behalf of all of us. And so on behalf of the Faculty of Law and all of us here tonight, Mr. Fraser, thank you very much indeed. Bye.